Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's Managed Hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta. Simply better hosting.
Everyone has a fave Wendy's Frosty flavor.
And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now there's all new Frosty Swirls and Frosty Fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo Brownie Fusion, Pop-Tarts Strawberry Fusion, Strawberry Swirl, Brownie Batter Swirl, Caramel Swirl, and Caramel Crunch Fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to Frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co., LLC. Used with permission.
Welcome back. We are taking a look at episode 3, season 2 of The Rings of Power. This is Tom or Robots as usual. I hope you've been enjoying these extra episodes. I decided clearly to start talking about each of these episodes one by one and kind of putting them into the feed a little bit extra. This one is taking the place of one of the normal episodes. Normally I'd be talking about The Hobbit right now, but I decided, you know what, let's catch up. Let's get up to speed with all three episodes so that we can then talk about episode 4 later this week, because that will have been out by now. And I haven't seen that yet. So this is all takes on episode 3 before seeing the rest of the season. So some of my predictions might be wrong, and we're just going to have to find out how that goes. So this episode, and just to remind you, I'm not going to go every scene by scene, but I'm going to point out the things that I think are most interesting to me about this episode. So we have the horse thing. The horse, like many other scenes and situations in this show, is a callback or a call forward, a foreshadowing, maybe, to some of the events that we see in the Peter Jackson films. And if you remember, Aragorn was able to calm down Brego. I believe Brego was the name of the horse. And that was attributed to the fact that he came from this. But well, both, he was raised by the elves, so he understood how to interact with nature and animals in a way that many men didn't. But he also came from this royal bloodline. What royal bloodline does he come from? Well, the two characters that we see are interacting with this horse, Elendil and Isildur. So it makes sense that we get these echoes or foreshadows of the horse thing with Aragorn. And in the movie version of the events, the horse pulls Aragorn out of the river and saves his life. Now, that doesn't happen in the books, but it is something that this is kind of referencing, because we have a situation, kind of a similar situation, where Isildur is now captured by these spiders and the horse comes to save him, which is a little silly. In fact, the special effects of the horse kicking the orc into the tree was a little, I mean, that horse really picks that orc up off the ground. I'm not sure horses kick that hard, but they got the point across. This is a royal level steed. This is a steed who will not just let anybody ride it, but will let kings ride it. And let's talk about Isildur. The situation we have in this episode with Isildur is one, like I noted before, reminiscent of Aragorn. We can see kind of the family lineage in the way that they make decisions. But Isildur is being set up to be a very noble and good character. He's also, even at this early stage in his life, he well understands how things work. He interacts with people on a certain level where he gives them respect. Even when he gets stabbed in the leg, he's quick to forgive and yet warns, no, you don't pull the knife out. Like, no, you leave it in. It's helping to keep the blood from flowing, like that kind of thing. Right. He understands things about the way the world works and people work. He's much more quick to give forgiveness than to hold a grudge. He has these noble attributes and he is very similar to his father in a lot of those ways. I think that's really cool because it sets up the situation where Isildur eventually gets the ring and the ring overwhelms him. And it shows us that even the people with the best intentions, even the best of us, even those who are noble and seem to have a more self-control than the average person, they stand for what they believe in. Even those people are corrupted by the ring. The ring will corrupt everyone. And I've seen this debated online before. Like, why are they making us like Isildur? Isn't he supposed to be a bad guy? And if you look at just the Peter Jackson films and you look at the gleam in his eye when he picks up the ring, I can picture it in my head. You go, oh, well, yeah, he's kind of not the greatest guy. Yeah, he fought Sauron. He stood up for his father and he cut the ring from Sauron's finger. But he wasn't a good king. Well, he would have been a good king. That's the point, is that he gets corrupted. And we have to see that character arc to really get a glimpse of how tragic that corruption really is. So let's move on to our look into the politics and the things going on in Numenor. We get a little bit more of an inside look at what's going on there, similar to the last episode where we got an inside look at what's going on with the dwarves. And in this situation, we are starting to see, and there were hints of this in the first season, we're starting to see Pharazôn and Pharazôn's, drive for power. And you can see that it doesn't all come from him in the beginning. There's the little discussion he has about the clothing and the colors of the clothing. She picks white. He goes, well, I think I'd rather have red. Those colors represent different things. She's going with tradition. He's going with, well, we need a new way forward. And then even at the ceremony, he's wearing red. If you notice, he does not match her and wear white. He stands in opposition to her based on the colors of the clothing that he chooses. She is marched out and looks like kind of a weak ruler. I mean, the idea that she can no longer see gives this impression that, well, she's vulnerable. She's weak. And that sets up a situation. But I'm getting ahead of myself again. Let's talk about the other things that are going on with the Numenoreans. I'm not sure how I feel about Elendil's daughter being part of the people who are standing against the faithful, is what they call them, the faithful, the people who still believe in the elves and upholding the things that Numenor was originally designed to uphold. Those are the traditionalists here, and that's the good side. And Elendil's daughter is, she finds the Palantir. She is speaking with people who are plotting ways that they can take control through Ar Pharazôn and his ascent to power. All of that feels very accurate to the way that this is discussed in the books, and it's actually very minimally discussed in the books, except for the fact that Elendil's daughter is a part of it. And I have to wonder if, similar to Isildur, that we are getting the beginning of a kind of a character arc, or we're being set up to see a tragic situation that divides her from the rest of her family. I'm not sure which way they're going to go with that. I think that there may be redemption for her at some point. I don't think she's supposed to be a bad guy so much as somebody who is misled and confused about what's going on. And I guess you could say that everybody is in some ways misled and confused, especially once we get to Sauron influencing Ar Pharazôn. But we're not there yet. We're basically at the point where dividing lines are coming about. And as we know from the lore, this happens over centuries. This division builds and kind of ebbs and flows over centuries. In fact, over a millennia even. So the show has to kind of show it developing a little bit at a faster pace, or at least coming to a head in these moments where the future of the Numenoreans feels like it's at stake. And then we have the scene with the eagle. And I'm sure people are misunderstanding this. And of course, the people who designed this episode want to make sure that we are not exactly sure what's going on if you don't know how the stories work. The idea that the eagle, who is a emissary of the Valar, who the eagles were known to, first of all, they were designed by Manwë himself, the greatest of the Valar, or at least the good Valar. Morgoth rebelled. Melkor, I guess I should say. But the Eagles are supposed to be emissaries of the Valar. They're supposed to watch over Numenor and kind of be there as a representation of the Valar, but also as a reminder that the Valar are watching. They are the ones who communicate messages back and forth. And I'm sure you could say that Manwë can see, as he's described in the Silmarillion, he can see when he's up in the towers, he can see across the entire land and all of that. Sure. But the Eagles are a physical representation of the idea that the Valar are still present. They still care. And it would be hard for me to argue, as I guess some might, that the Eagle did show up for Pharazôn. The Eagle does not show up for Pharazôn. The Eagle is not there. Pharazôn takes the opportunity of the Eagle to position himself in front of the Eagle and for everyone to then say, you know, hail Pharazôn instead of Muriel. The Eagle was supposed to be there for Muriel. She is the one who stands with the faithful. She is the one who would lead Numenor in the right direction according to the perspective of the Valar or the elves. Pharazôn is not. And we will see this continue to fall apart as this season and maybe next season continue. You probably listened to the first episode where I predicted the way that this would play out. But I have a feeling that things are going to get a lot worse during this season, and then we're going to see the full corruption of Numenor in season three. That would be my expectation. All right, so let's talk about what's going on with the people who are now living in the south. And we have some of the remnants of the south folk who were primarily destroyed or at least taken over and swayed to Adar's side. And then we have those Numenoreans at that the little village that they have that are surviving there and taking in some of the people who are refugees. The situation with Bronwyn is interesting. Bronwyn, obviously, was a character from season one. The actress decided not to come back for season two, from what I understand. So I have to wonder if she originally was planned to be offed in this season or if they adjusted the writing for that. Either way, I think she's supposed to be a tragic character, somebody who affects the, we'll call it the arc of Arondir and Theo's stories. We're starting to see the beginning of that in this episode, where Arondir is trying to help Theo, but Theo doesn't really want the help. And then Isildur shows up and then tells his story, and then it kind of touches Theo. And of course, we have speculation around this. The discussion online is, who is Theo's father? Was it Arondir? Is Theo actually half-blood? Maybe. And one of the things people point out is that we never really get a glimpse of his ears. His hair is constantly covering his ears. And I guess he could have elf-like ears. That could be possible. It may also play into why Arondir is sticking around so much. Why does he even plan to stay with these people? Especially if Bronwyn is gone. Maybe because he wants to watch over Theo. Maybe he cares from the perspective of somebody who was already close to the family, and that's it. Or maybe he's the father. There is the scene where they talk together and Theo basically says, "You're not my father," which may be foreshadowing to, surprise, he really is. We don't really know. We don't know yet. What I find interesting about these scenes is that we have three very different characters. We have Isildur, who is showing actually four very different characters. We have Isildur, who is a primary character. We know what happens to Isildur. And he's also been nerfed, kind of like in the last episode where I talked about the Stranger being nerfed and if he was a full-powered wizard, how that would just solve all the problems. Well, Isildur is going to be a wonderful, powerful warrior, a leader of men, all of these things, and yet he was stabbed in the leg. So we have the scene where they are attacked and then Arondir shows up and help save them. We get to again see how he's kind of a badass with a bow, like Legolas. And we don't get to see what Isildur can do in that kind of situation here. But I think we will see more later. And the fact that he does survive in that situation with all the spiders, which, well, let's discuss that while I'm on it, is clearly Shelob's brood, right? These are spiders that Shelob has parented. Or they are descendants of descendants, or something like that. We see one of the spiders is bigger than the others, but I'm pretty sure that one is not Shelob. Shelob, by this point in the histories, would have already been fairly large. and considerably larger than even the biggest spiders we see in that scene. So I don't think we actually see a fight with Shelob herself. I think we're still seeing children of Shelob, or the children of the children of Shelob, or something like that. But it makes sense. This region would have spiders in it. Shelob is already hiding away in this part of the world. So that all tracks. Let's talk about the four characters, though. We have Isildur, who we don't get to see at his full strength because he's been wounded and all of that. We have Theo, who is, by the end of this episode, looks like he's going to go along with the people who are for Adar or Adar. But I don't think he is. I don't think that's the plan. I think he's trying to fool them. I don't think he actually wants to serve them. Maybe he's taking risks because he's willing to throw his life away because he doesn't feel like he has that much to live for or something like that. I'm sure there's some point there. Then we have Arondir, who shows up and we're reminded that he's a badass, but there's definitely something else going on with him and Theo. That is the only piece of motivation we have left for him in this situation, unless it's just simply like, I failed and now I owe all of these people in order to try to right my wrongs. Maybe. I think it's probably more personal than that. And then we have the girl that stabs Isildur, and we find out is one of Adar's people. I think what we have in that situation is either she's a spy and she's terrible from the beginning, or she's seeking redemption. She did what she had to do to survive. She was branded, and now she's trying to find a way out. I think that's where we're at with that. But all of this stuff ends with a scene where big monsters come out of the woods in the dark, and they're trying real hard to make us think that this is the big troll that we just met during that part of the episode. Spoilers. And I haven't seen any further in the season, but it's not. Those are Ents. The Ents have shown up. And they talk about these woods. Remember when in the Lord of the Rings, where they're talking about Fangorn Forest, and Gimli gets all worried, and I think it's Legolas who says something like, those woods are dark and mysterious and dangerous, and people who go, you go in, you don't ever come out, whatever that was, whatever those lines were. You remember. This is a very similar situation, and they're pulling from that scene. You have the discussion about this black forest, or whatever they call it, and how it's very dangerous, and let him go, he'll never come back out, that sort of thing. Exactly the same sort of thing. This situation is different. The forest does look different than Fangorn, right? It is dark and mysterious. It looks like a lot of the wood is kind of charred or burned or just black or something. And the color palette on these scenes is very dark. We get a lot of night stuff. We get a lot of desaturation. And we're supposed to think it's dark and dangerous, not just because there's orcs in the forest and not just because there's spiders in the forest, although that could be part of it. It's because there's Ents in the forest. And the Ents, as we know, serve themselves. They are not on anyone else's side because nobody's on their side, right? And so if you're going to march into their forest with ill intent, then you're going to have to deal with them. And I think that's the situation we're seeing play out here. We have these groups of people, these groups of men working for Adar who are not treating the forest with respect. They are burning things. They are working their way through the forest with the goal of attacking any of the survivors who didn't sign up with them and furthering Adar and the orcs' goals. And that doesn't mean that they're very nice to the forest, or at least they don't really hold it with any respect. And so the Ents would see them as invaders. And that's what we're seeing in this situation. And I think this is going to play out in the next episode, probably, where we actually get to see what happens. I think similar to Merry and Pippin, we will have a scene where Theo is confronted with the Ents. The Ents have killed most of the rest of them. And then Theo has to justify himself as being not one of them or something like that. Kind of like they thought Merry and Pippin were orcs. Maybe something like that'll play out. I think it'll be pretty similar.
Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's Managed Hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
So let's talk about orcs. This is probably the most controversial scene in the show so far as I can tell from the online discussions. We have an orc. We have another orc. And the other orc is holding a baby. Yeah, so all in one scene, we have the confirmation of female orcs and orcs give birth. Orcs have families. Orcs have babies. And some orcs care about their families. You could see a certain level of compassion between the male orc, the female orc, and the child. They are a family unit. And this is driving some people nuts on the internet. I've had conversations with a few people about this, and from what I can tell, the argument is orcs are supposed to just be bad guys. They're supposed to be fodder that the good guys fight and kill. They don't represent anything else. That's not what Tolkien wanted. Or that's what Tolkien originally wanted, and I don't really care if Tolkien later on in his life may have had second thoughts about designing the orcs that way. And so therefore, the orcs shouldn't be like this, period. That's the argument that I've seen. And let me say that to take the author's intent and not use that in your perspective is missing the point. That doesn't make any sense to me. The author's intent should be taken into consideration. Anytime you work on a piece of art, especially something like writing novels, your perspective of your own work will change over time. You will grow more and more familiar with what you are trying to say and how you're trying to say it. And Tolkien was wonderful at going back and making edits that made his worlds and his different writings more in line with each other. He does this in ways that some authors never do. This is one of those things that would have been very difficult for him to go back and change, because in most of his works, we are led to believe, and remember, we see these writings through the people who wrote them. This is not an all-knowing, all-seeing narrator who's writing The Lord of the Rings or The Silmarillion. No, this is a hobbit writing down their experiences, or this is the elves making chronicles of history. This is from their perspectives. And from their perspectives, if you come across orcs in the wild, they try to kill you, you're going to demonize them and see them as being 100% evil with no redemption and no redeeming qualities at all. It makes sense that they were written from that perspective. But when you get into Tolkien's later writings and discussions and some of the letters that he wrote people, he wasn't sure about that. We've discussed this on the show. Originally, orcs were corrupted elves. Eventually, orcs became corrupted elves and also maybe men. And then that led to conversations where he would say things like, the orcs multiply in the same way that the children of Iluvatar do, meaning elves and men. That means that they must have male orcs and female orcs, and they must have babies. They are biological creatures just like any other. And one of the things this season is doing that's really driving people nuts is it's trying to make the orcs more approachable. It's trying to make us level with them and see them as individuals with maybe their own justifications for their own survival, their own evil deeds, all of these things. And I'm not saying this to take sides so much as to fill out our understanding about them. And one of my arguments is we have seen orcs as 100% evil things that just need to be killed and gotten rid of because they are terrible and there's no redemption for them. We've seen that represented in movies and other takes on this world. What we haven't seen is this other perspective, the perspective that Tolkien was moving more towards in his later part of his life. And the fact that we have now both perspectives seems to drive people nuts because they're like, well, now there's inconsistencies. But in my mind, we are actually more consistent with Tolkien because we are getting both perspectives. I use this as an analogy on the Discord. I was explaining that the justification that just because the first way something is written is the earlier one doesn't mean it's the more right one. Also, just because the second justification is the clarification that the author comes to later on in life doesn't mean that the earlier one is wrong necessarily. It just means that they had a change of mind. It also means that they didn't live out the rest of their lives to a place where they necessarily felt like they were concluded, and that they totally understood where they wanted to go with that. This was a dilemma until Tolkien's last days, as far as we can tell. So, for example, if I were writing a journal and I was journaling my thoughts, and early in my life, I thought it was a good idea to punch old ladies in the face. And then later on in life, I decided I had a change of heart, and I explained the ways that I'd realized that, you know what, punching old ladies in the face probably isn't a good idea. So I no longer believe in that. In fact, I think people who punch old ladies in the face are wrong, and they should go to jail for assault on old women. Which one, if you were to read my journals, would you say is my view on this, on the topic? The first one, because it was the original one, and then because I contradicted it later, I was wrong? Probably not. The second one, because it seems like the better thing to do, and I decided, you know, I was going to redeem myself because I realized my previous actions were bad? Maybe. But if you were doing a biography about me, the only way to be accurate would be to state both. That's what we're getting. We're getting versions of Tolkien's stories where we are seeing both. We are seeing orcs as 100% evil, irredeemable villains, but we are also, in this version, seeing orcs as potentially redeemable. They potentially have souls. And I think the nuance of this drives some people nuts. How can you have both? You can have both. No, you can. You can have both. Tolkien had both. You read his works, both are there. So to erase either one would be inaccurate. That's my perspective. I'm not saying I prefer one or the other, although I do have a preference. What I'm saying is, if this is going to be lore accurate, then both is actually the most lore accurate you can be, period. So there you go. And I'm sure people are going to disagree with me on this, and they're going to say, no, you have to pick one and all of that. That's fine. Do whatever you need to get through your day. But I think that there's probably more nuance here that if you open yourself up to, you can be okay with, because it's fiction. These aren't real stories, right? At the end of the day, and I guess this is another way to look at it, if you were charting the events of, let's just use ancient Rome, because everybody's always thinking about ancient Rome. If you're charting the events of like Julius Caesar, at the end of the day, there's only one true version of what actually happened. And chances are any description of what actually happened is going to be flawed in some way. So we have to try to figure out what the actual truth of the situation was, because it was freaking history, because that's how history works. Only one thing can be true in a historical situation. X person did Y or Z. Which one? One of those things has to be true, right? And in fantasy and in fiction, it's not a real world. There isn't a single version of the events. In fact, the only canon version, if you go back to my canonization episode, that you could say about anything, in my opinion, has to come from the authority, the person who wrote it, or the person who then has rights to it. But ultimately, with something like Tolkien, it goes back to the person who wrote it because he held on to it so strongly. And if their perspective is torn, then that is the perspective, because he didn't come to a conclusion. There is 100% a conclusion about what Frodo's name is, and it's Frodo. It's not one of the other ones he was tossing around, including Aragorn. No, it's Frodo, because he landed on that and decided that that was final and then no longer debated it. So it doesn't make sense to have a version of The Lord of the Rings where Frodo is named Aragorn as a show or movie. That doesn't make any sense. It's a different kind of thing. But with the orcs, he didn't come to a final conclusion. So both views are actually right. It's better to see both than to see only one. So that's my perspective. If you disagree with me on it, please feel free to share your thoughts on the Discord in a respectful manner. I would love to have more conversations about this, but let's maintain respect. Let's absolutely make sure we do that. So one other scene I didn't talk about yet is the scene where they are making the rings, and the dwarves decide that they're going to be part of this. There's the whole debate with, is this the right thing to do? Is it not the right thing to do? Durin the Younger has his suspicions. I like that he is also suspicious. I like that Annatar tries to influence him, and he understands that he's lying because he's like, Elrond would never say that about me because I know him too well. All of that works out great. I like the fact that the king is desperate, and so the king moves forward with it. And then in that final scene where they're about to put the Mithril in the mix, Annatar, Sauron, takes hold of it and is the one who drops it in. And clearly it's at that moment that he corrupts the material and then leads to the domination of those rings. So that's cool. And I think we're going to get a few more of these scenes. I'm interested. The one question I have about the dwarf rings and the rings for men is that we haven't been introduced to all of the dwarf lords or all of the kings of men, the people who would eventually get these rings. Now, we probably will get glimpses of them at some point, but I don't think that that's the point of the way this story is playing. We are seeing, on the whole, what happens to everyone who gets one of these rings with a single example. And we can assume that everyone else who gets one of these rings goes through something very similar. I think that's where we're at with it. But that raises the question, and it's not begs the question. Everyone uses begs the question. Go look it up. It's not begs the question. That's not how we use actually you're supposed to use that. But anyway, it raises the question that if we are seeing one of the dwarven lords who is about to be corrupted by one of the dwarf rings, and we've gotten to know him, then who's the Witch King? And then that question goes back to maybe Theo? Possibly? He seems kind of young for that. But who else will it be? I think we are of the understanding that I never can remember his name. The guy who was worshiping Adar, the evil human guy. I'm not sure if he's supposed to become one. I mean, it seems like he's eaten by the wolf in the previous episode, but or two episodes before this, I think it was the first episode. But is he supposed to live somehow? And then he becomes. I don't think that works, right? So either Theo is the Witch King, or the guy who I think is the Blue Wizard, who I explained earlier, is going to be the Witch King because he's not actually a wizard, but I think he's pretty much a wizard. I think he's not the Witch King. So does that mean we haven't met the Witch King yet? Does that have to do with the forming of Gondor and Arnor, maybe? And the butting of heads of local little kingdoms that exist in other places that we haven't really found yet? Not sure how that's going to play out. So if you have thoughts on that and you have any ideas that might elucidate this and predict what's going to happen, I'd love to hear those predictions. Thank you again for tuning in. I hope you have a wonderful week, and I'm so excited to talk about episode 4 as soon as I'm able to watch it and get back on track with our Hobbit close reading. So I hope you join us for that. And of course, there's the Patreon. I didn't do a mid-break here, but thank you to all of our patrons. I will read out the new patrons who signed up and reviews and things on the next episode once we're back to our close reading of The Hobbit, because it kind of fits in that format better. And but in the meantime, thank you. I've noticed a number of you joining. Welcome to the Patreon, and I will very soon get your shout out there. So don't worry about that. Thanks for being here, everybody. Have a wonderful rest of your week, and I'll see you next time.